I think this might be characteristic of many cities, would you agree with that?
This is a good reason why we need that kind of person available in details.
Mr. President, on that line, this, you got the part of a question of federalism, and that is, many cities, as opposed to having property tax rates or income tax, what have you, are obtaining most of their revenues now from user charges, service charges, or somehow trying to get some equity that way, being boxed in by state statutes otherwise. And it seems to me that if in the wage price freeze, local governments or counties or maybe even states are frozen into a position of literal bankruptcy simply because their revenue side is going to be impossible to achieve, then we have a rather violent disruption of the whole process. And of course we're...
Because your user charges will be frozen?
Yes. And I think we have to have, in order to maintain the integrity of our local governments, some very strong upward possibilities of scratching around almost everywhere we can to make the revenue side work out. The expense side can be pretty well frozen in by what has occurred, perhaps by the flexibility of productivity regulations, although we're inclined to feel maybe local governments, state governments, a little different to the bank than Prime Minister, but even after we've done that, still, if we have, let's say, civil disorder, catastrophe of that sort, we need a lot of money to pay the police force, or the Environmental Control Agency decides that our river is badly polluted and we'll have to do something about it immediately, there's not going to be any chance, and the credibility of government all the way through suffers very badly when the federal government mandates this or something for our own health and safety, we have to perform functions. All I'm hopeful is that phase two will offer, at least in terms of the intergovernmental relation problem, some way of our being able, if we were willing, to take the political risk to raise money to finance our governments without being restricted.
You know, one thing that this dialogue brings to mind, I think it brings to me, as I say, I had the same feeling as I talked to business leaders and related leaders in this role. And then, of course, to the agriculture. When you hear the infinite complexity of these problems, it shows you why we cannot and should not assume we should have a permanent system of waste and price control. It's permanent. I think Laura Hearns has made a good point in the sense that we must have something in phase two that does not just say, well, we're going to go 90 days. We can be sure it's going to be more than that. But if you talk about in our country, of a permanent system of wage and price controls, we're just going to get ourselves wound up in a mass of bureaucracy that's going to stifle the creativity and drive of this economy in every way. It hadn't even occurred to me, for example, that a user charge would be subject to a
Could you have a percentage increase of horizon which would be flexible in higher and lower incomes and smaller and higher incomes for the second phase so that you at least be able to move forward to some kind of a percentage increase both in the wages? I have the same problem with the selling of bonds in order to have our public facilities. We have to be able to justify the income that we can sell those bonds.
Mr. President, if I may comment on that, sir, I might suggest that they consider a net minimum exemption specifically we in South Carolina.
Well, it was respect to
on labor income. To give you the example, unfortunately it's not something we're proud of, but in South Carolina nearly half of our state employees make less than $6,000 a year. Many of them make barely the minimum wage. We've had problems in attendance and safety and education institutions and so on. These are the people that, frankly, we're having the problems with. They're actually below the poverty level, almost at the poverty level. We've got labor difficulties. We had a Charleston hospital strike. I remember we're trying to avoid other such incidents. And if we could say exempt wages, it might not be practical. Below $6,000 or $5,000, us avoid some real problems, and I don't know, it may not be possible.
Mr. President, I have a suggestion that might be helpful in that area, and I want to say that I support you all the way through. I think the people of America are very concerned about this, and I hope that you will continue your forthrightness in this area. Just say that as we go around this table and talk, I notice that we are consumed with the idea that we got to have more money. We got to pay more weight. We can't have our cake and eat it too. Now, specifically to this point, I believe, and I'd like to suggest that if you go into the area of some guidelines in this issue, let's take a 3%, 4%, or 5% average increase, cost of living increase. Maybe it could be done in this area, you know, saying, establishing a man that makes $6,000 a year. A 5% increase in wages isn't very much, but when you take a $20,000 a year man or a $60,000 a year man and say 5% of that is his cost of living increase, then that's not true. Somewhere there is a base that is arbitrary with economists, I'm sure, as to where what does it cost you to live? Maybe we could work something like that in this area. In addition, I'd like to say I'm not an economist. Just a businessman, but I would think that you've heard it before, a freeze on interest rates or drop of some kind, certainly corporate profits and possibly dividends. And I think that we're all ready to make some sacrifices. And the only problem I see, and I'm very happy to hear you say that phase two will have an indefinite period. I would also caution you, Mr. President, I am afraid that your announcement the other day that the freeze would go off at the end of 90 days has been taken by a large segment of our society. That, boy, the lift's going to be off now, and I better go in for as big a raise as I possibly can so they don't put it on once again. And after listening to you today, I thought before you were indicating that while the freeze, which was described to us earlier as a 90-day obvious action that you had to take, but the freeze will end, but that does not mean that you're going to throw the lid off prices and wages, and I'm afraid that in certain segments of our economy, your statement was taken that way.
Mr. President, could they discuss your experts, so-called experts, on this, my mind worried a bit about one of the requests he had, and if they could discuss that question. I know you're tired of hearing, but the possibility of freezing profits. Jim believes this, and it makes a good case. It's repugnant to me, but if it's necessary, I would just, I know they've advised you to your blue in the face on that particular item, but it'd be very enlightening for me to hear it from somebody
that knows the answers to this. Let me take a flyer. Because I think having to talk about profits rather than Charlie Bachman, who's an expert in the field, might be more useful. Especially it's a political problem, not an economic problem. Now, let's first look at the political problem. Brooke Ogden follows that very well. That politically, they're beginning more popular than getting the big man. In other words, get profits from the business and gets the rich guy. That's what really makes it more fit politically. And we were keenly aware of this. So when we were meeting the candidate, we went over all this. And I said, all right, what about profits? So here's the situation. Just a few facts. First, with regard to profits. When you have a freeze and later phase two, a restraint on prices, profits are to that extent controlled. In other words, you can't control the price and the wages without controlling profits. The only way you get more profits under those circumstances is to increase production. Now, if you increase production, what happens? If you increase production to make more profits, what does that lead to? Well, that leads to more jobs, which is what you want. It also means that every dollar in more profits, 50 cents of that goes to the federal government for the purpose of allowing us to pay for revenue sharing, for welfare reform, for all the other things we have to do. You know, 50% of every bit of corporate profit goes to the federal government. And so, and this gets back really to what some of you, all of you, remember, all of us, at least remember, were doing the excess profit tax. In fact, how hard it was to get rid of it. We had to get rid of it after the war, because an excess profits tax has the effect of first contributing to inefficiency, and second, it has the effect of discouraging growth in the economy. Now let's come to the other point. But what about profits? Are they, here again, I'm not suggesting any of you are politicians, but I think it's public. What about the, are they too high? We find that, as Secretary Connolly pointed out in his testimony, the Ways and Means Committee, that profits as a share of the American GNP are the lowest they've been since 1938 in the United States. Now don't cry any tears over General Motors or any other. A lot of them make plenty of money. The point is that in order for the United States to become, again, more competitive in the world, rather than cutting profits, we've got to have more so that we can plow back into the companies of this country what is necessary to get the new equipment and, frankly, get up to a place so we can compete with the Japanese, who have the most modern steel plant in the world, and the Germans and all the rest. So I come back to this proposition that we have two problems here. We have the problem of increasing employment and reducing unemployment. We have the problem also of checking inflation. Now, as far as the employment side is concerned, there isn't any question that putting some sort of a lid on profits would have exactly the opposite effect of what we would want. It would depress the economy. It would stifle its growth rather than encourage it. From the standpoint of the inflation side, putting a lid on prices does the trick. In other words, prices handles the inflation side. You look at the profit thing on the ground another way you could look at it is in terms of taxes. Now, since 19, as you know, we had a comprehensive tax reform, which was the result of the actions of both parties in the House and Senate in 1969. From 1969 to 1973, just to get it perspective, that tax reform provides $34 billion of relief to individuals, most of it in the lower income bracket. It provides $1 billion of relief to corporations. What I'm getting at is this, that I speak again political. From a political standpoint, I know there wouldn't be anything more popular for me to go out and root around and say, let's limit the profits of these big corporations and not let them make a problem out of the fact that others are sacrificing. On the other hand, I know, as I sit here, that if that were done, it would mean that we would not have what we need in terms of more growth, more jobs, and America becoming more competitive in a world in which we either are going to be more competitive or have a little water on ourselves, generally is worse. So that's the reason I had to make the decision. Because it's hard for me to sell, but that's what we're going to do.
Yeah. I think you explained that. I'd just like to ask another question along the same line.
Sure.
The regulations with respect to depreciation.
Depreciation.
The now matter of concern in the Congress is that I read the newspapers and the stitch for that, you've got the investment tax credit. And I'm no expert in these matters, so that I'm not proposing to any experts, but I know the answers to them. I'm really trying to find them.
Sure, absolutely.
It's more of whatever. We have unused capacity of about 25%. Wouldn't it be a better push for the economy if instead of having both the accelerated depreciation and investment tax credit, that we made the readjustment with respect to taxes on the other side so we get some of both rather than do this. I'd like an explanation.
Well, I'm sure to get it. Because you, and incidentally, up in Rhode Island, where you've got a lot of strong business community up there too, and they seem to make, but I mean, hit that one right straight on. How many lawyers? All of us. We all know why. We all know what the depreciation allowance does. The purpose of the depreciation allowance, the faster it is to do that. Well, that's finance of the business. Could be sometimes that any smart tax lawyer is going to find a way to get his business quiet, find a way to write this, that, and all the depreciation. On the other hand, you can't depreciate anything unless you buy something. You got to have something to depreciate. Now, you got to lose capacity, aren't you? That's what the history of the investment tax credit. It's not new with us. We call it a job development credit. It's called investment. John Kennedy recommended. He would write to recommend. Matter of fact, we should have recommended it in 1959, in my opinion. George Shultz, who was then advising this among, and not, he wasn't on the council, but he was there, will remember that along with the late Jim Mitchell, whom some of you may remember, who was Secretary of Labor, that I pushed very hard, you were on March, you recall, to get us to move in. But let's look and see what the economy was. In 1961, when President Kennedy recommended the investment tax credit, there was more unused capacity than there is today. Unemployment was 6 7/10% average in 61. But he recommended it. Why? He recommended it because he knew that the way to get ahead of employment, there are two ways to actually increase purchasing power on one side, and that is provide tax relief for consumers. Another way, you can get incentives to those who will produce jobs. And when you say to a corporation, look here, if you go out and buy this or that new equipment, you will get this kind of a tax incentive. That has an enormous effect in stimulating the economy. It worked that way. It wasn't passed till 62, and the effects were not really felt till 64 and 65. And that was not until 64 and 65 that the unemployment rate began to come down. Now, on the unused capacity argument, let me put this in the world context. We do have unused capacity. George Meany made the same point when he was here. And he makes the points very effectively. And rhetoric is pretty good. Anyway, I know some of those words too, and I use them. Yes, we have unused capacity. One of the reasons a lot of America's capacity is unused is its inefficient capacity. What we need to do, and I can't emphasize too strongly, as we sit around this table, Democrats and Republicans, we have got to recognize that the United States, the salad days are over in terms of competition in the world. Now, this doesn't mean we all run to the hills, because we're still the richest, we're still the strongest, we're still the most, in my view, the most productive people in the world, we will continue to be. But on the other hand, we're in a race now. We're in a race with all those that we helped after the war. Warren, you were in World War II, a lot of us were. What happened? We helped the Germans, we helped the Japanese. They're our biggest competitors in the world today. They're beating our pants off. We're wondering why. Because the American plant was built 25 years ago, and theirs was destroyed. So everything they have is new. Many of the things we have are new, but a lot of them aren't. You go through New England, you see a lot of old plants up there, right? You go out through Russia, there's a lot of old plants. As a matter of fact, I think we have to go further than even this job investment credit. I think we've got to go further on the depreciation credit. And we're looking into this. I believe that in order for America to be able to compete, and I want her to be able to compete, with the Japanese and with the United Europe, with the British and that common market, that's going to be an enormous economic unit. What we have to do is to encourage our businesses to refurbish, to develop, to have research and so forth, so that American goods can be sold around the world with our much higher wage scales.
and be competitive, and they can be. So my answer on your, my first point, with regard to unused capacity, yes, there is. But the fact that it's unused does not mean that it's efficient. What we have to, we want to do is to get more efficient capacity and get it done. Second point is that I'm convinced that that efficiency in itself would have a very stimulating effect on the economy. Not in terms of just the fact that they buy machine tools and so forth, which has an immediate effect, but in terms that it makes those goods and those workmen more competitive in the world, which is what we need to do. I want to see the American worker, who is the highest paid worker in the world, be able to compete with somebody who is paid less, because we have a more efficient plan. And we will not have a more efficient plan unless people put more money into that sort of thing. Now, we can overstate that case. It is true, and let me say, these tax things have got to be very carefully examined. I know a lot of smart tax lawyers, and I know a lot of business people that, you know, find ways to use appreciation. Probably you know a lot. But I do feel that in the long run, it's the way for America to become competitive again. Yes?
Mr. President, some argue that Congress appropriates funds that you're not willing to spend at this time. We recognize that President Johnson received the same criticism. I'm wondering if the unemployment situation wouldn't be so serious as to encourage you to release those funds at the first point. And secondly, as much as the unemployment situation is still very serious, won't it add to it and reduce federal employment by 5%?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, yes. Well, George, as the budget director, I'll throw that to you. You've answered it before.
One historical point in there. They started empowering government funds with President Jefferson.
Every president since then has done so. Not an excuse, it's just something to say.
But you know that, right?
And it's just one of the, it's one of those things that come back to question. But I think that's still, the meat of the question is still there, so that's the idea.
Every governor's done the same thing. Not only did the government, because he would be caught in our president's Republican.
Sure.
The proportion of funds that are under any definition compounded is lower right now than in, I think, something like 7 out of the past 10 years. If you want to think of the flow of federal funds as a big flow into a tank and then a flow out again, and you have a kind of a holding operation there, and you measure what's in the tank in proportion to the flow, by historical standards. I think it's important to understand why you have some of this money in the tank. If the Navy gets an appropriation to build a new submarine, they let a contract that takes quite a period of time to actually build that submarine. Say it takes 3 years. We tell the Navy, all right, go ahead and let the contract. And they notify us when the first payment comes due. Then we release the funds to make that payment. The balance of the funds that have been appropriated are held in reserve. You don't gain anything by releasing more funds to the Navy to build that ship. It's on its own schedule and the money goes forward. So I think the first point is that there are the importance of the number of funds, the amount of funds impounded, has been way overstated. Now, in terms of the federal budget, we try to weigh this in terms of the budget as a whole and the uses to which the resources the federal government gets are put. And I think in terms of the stimulative effects of the budget, you have to look at the overall picture. And here we have a picture in fiscal 1972 where we estimate the outflow of money from the federal government will be something on the order of $27 to $28 billion more than the inflow. Now that is a big stimulative impact. Now you can rearrange that impact by spending more on this kind of thing, less on that kind of thing. You can say that the deficit should be larger. Some people have argued that.
Well, in matter of fact, Governor, there is a
basic judo conflict among economists. Warren Heller from your state.
Warren, I call him one. There was a great Pittsburgh football player.
Yes, Eric. I played in the Rose Bowl.
Lost 25-0. Our rising costs have gotten like 2/5 of our
10 years?
Yes.
One section.
Also, we recognize that the principal effect of the section is a reduction of the government revenues, which are related to the business and market levels. Now, the position, the summary of the position, which we've worked out, is a summary of the position we have, which I have United States Conference of Veterans. And we will, very frankly, have some disagreement in detail in our supporting document, but we agree with these general thesis. I will file a supporting document of our several points of summary. And I'll be very brief and just simply give you the high points of summary. Your time doesn't permit here. Allows for us to go in substance these of our pieces. Even if this is happening a long time, we're trying to get our foot and feet at the table. You have invited us in. We are afraid of some of the effects of the proposed policies on revenue sharing, on the point that was made earlier that Ways and Means Committee is taking it off the calendar now. And we spell out what we think the possible effect of permanent losses of federal revenue would mean in two areas to us and our efforts to relieve the plight of the citizens. Now, we have very subtle, but we think a logically woven argument on this, but we're not going to take the time to try to tie this together. Point two, you've already covered, and that is that representatives of local government should anticipate determination of policies and agree to that. We feel that the new economic policy fails to utilize the contribution the public sector can make in combating the problem of a sluggish economy and high unemployment rates. And while we definitely applaud the value of stimulating economy through tax policy. As I mentioned, we believe a permanent loss of revenues which would affect local government is undesirable and clear of the clear needs of local government for additional funds, which we recognize. And we accordingly reaffirm strongly our commitment to an early enactment of a general revenue sharing program. We believe that the Emergency Employment Act should double in size to relieve unemployment. And we certainly reassert our position that any empowerment funds for urban development should be used. We further propose a revenue stabilization program, anticipatory of the future, by which federal funds can be transferred to local governments and set the loss of local revenues. So an automatic fire sprinkling system for the future. And that, Mr. President, summarizes our position. I say again, the augmentation, belief in the view and interpretation of the position of U.S. Congress of Mayors will apply out of the Senate
meeting. Let me respond on two comments from the mayor that I know have been covered earlier, and I want to say to this group and ask for your help. Revenue sharing may appear to be on the back burner as far as the Congress is concerned. It's not on the back burner as far as you're concerned. We are for it all out. We are pushing with everything that we have, and we would appreciate all of you keeping on the Congress. After all, they're going to get through this tax in a few ways and means. It can't take more than 30 days, probably. I hope so. But in any event, there's a revenue sharing. They had all sorts of hearings on the thing. They should be ready to act on it. And there isn't any reason why, in this session of this Congress, revenue sharing should not be enacted. I don't want to hold it out. Don't spend the money yet. But I can assure you that our commitment there, the same is true of welfare reform. We're going to continue to push on the welfare reform. That, I would have to say, is a more difficult one because it has a more, in the Senate, where it's hung up, it has some philosophical battles there that are harder to resolve. But on both, we're going to push it. And revenue sharing, I think, has such enormous support in the country and among governors and among county officials and among mayors that revenue sharing can be passed. But you've got to help keep the heat on.
because we've got them at least, and you see, we've got it in the budget for, we just slipped it 3 months because they aren't going to pass it by October 1st. So,
I know.
And incidentally, I think the line should be, the Congress should not go home after revenue sharing. They're talking now about adjourning about the 15th of November. Now, that's just irresponsible. The Congress should stay here till Christmas and give revenue sharing to the mayors and the rest of the business president.
We made this agreement so that there's no misunderstanding. We felt that the last economic investment major position quite clear.
But there was an earlier.
Well, I know, but the last message clarified any misunderstanding. I think in our visit to the vice president today was a double reassurance on your position. We are the spirit of some of the arguments, and again, this is not we're going to be from the contemporary arguments we met. Where is the money coming from? Where is the money coming from? Well, 5 years, we've been saying, maybe it'll have to come from highways, space, military, everything you're spending on. Maybe it'll have to come. But it doesn't. The country is not going to be facing up to its number one domestic crisis,
which is serious.
And now we're afraid that if we have a permanent loss of revenue, we're going to run into that argument even stronger. And we recognize the dilemma of the administration. I guess it's the first time in history we've had to fight on a recession and fight inflation at the same time. And we're hopeful that some of the things we do will prove to be a cost purposes, which I'm sure is right.
Mr. President, the state legislators through the ninth National Legislative Conference have supported your efforts for revenue sharing in many different ways from everything from the period between before.
Been great.
But you've also sent letters personally to our congressional delegations who are trying to get the 7,716 state legislators to do this. But one thing that worries us is that we are going to be the culprits because we're going to be raising the taxes for these governors around the table next year. We do not have some of the discretion sharing. I urge you, and we will continue with our efforts to get the Congress to enact less discretion sharing. But I want to let you know we support it very much and we'll continue to do so.
Could I ask one thing? If I could, you're the new chairman, mayors, and also the county officials and state officials. I know this is wrong, but go back and let your respective representatives in Congress know again of your continued interest in revenue sharing. That is where I zero in on. If you need it, I don't mean to suggest that some of you aren't for it, but if you do it, all of you who are for it, believe me, it'll help. Do you think so much about it?
We talked about that in our earlier meetings.
We need to meet on that.
Mr. President,
yeah, Charlie.
Mr. President, John Berkman and I, the Secretary of Commerce leadership, have been managing the legislation on the Hill, and I said through all of the executive sessions for the recess. You don't have to give anything away. The bill was moving towards resolution. All we've got to do is get a few hearings going again. You don't have to say, we'll take a Mills plan, or we'll take this plan, or that plan. So all we've got to do is hold what we got.
President, on that line, we've been in communication, the new executive committee has been in communication. We had hoped perhaps before the day was up that we'd have a chance to engage in conversation, but obviously the late hour caused him some problems. But we're advised that he stands ready to meet us on Monday or Tuesday of next week, and we're going to be knocking on his door.
Well, he is, let me say this, you know, you all are the reason I made the right height, you know, who's going to get the credit for this kind of thing. He'll give it back to the president here. Wilbur Mills is one of the ablest men in this country in terms, you not only understand, you all serve with him, you know, he knows taxes. He's like Johnny Burton. The two of them are really a couple of real giants in terms of an understanding of the tax system and all the rest. And they, each of them in his way, for deep philosophical reasons, has not favored revenue sharing as we have recommended it. On the other hand, Wilbur Mills is a very astute politician. And I think that just keep it going. And
Rubber mills, quite that to the fact. You don't get a truth. Yes, that's why I look at
it. We talked about it this morning, this afternoon, and everybody agrees that the plan, the basic fundamentals of the plan were the product of a bipartisan evolution of 10 years within the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. And some of the very people who are cool or disinterested in the plan happened to serve on the Advisory Commission at the time when the plan germinated and had a part in its evolution, which surprises me a little.
And also, it had the bipartisan thing, and Governor Anderson, as you know, Walter Heller was the first one to suggest revenue sharing, at least in the White House level area, and is a strong supporter of it.
Mr. President, just one thing to say is, as Warren Hearns pointed out, I agree our role here today to help you make this work. Any way we can into it doesn't really require a response, but I would hope that your experts would not ignore two or three things. As Governor Anderson pointed out, the impoundment of funds, Governor Evans in Washington has, if not the highest, one of the highest unemployment rates.
So he
tells me personally that there's $155 million of impounded highway funds he could use. I would hope that these would be recognized. Furthermore, about the only thing that hasn't been discussed here, I come from an agricultural state, an export state. We do a lot of business in the Orient, and certainly that surtax has helped the automobile industry. I would hope that your intelligence would tell you undoubted things that we do not have access to, but whether they are looking at retaliation, because if it comes to that, it's going to hurt us, and it's going to hurt other agricultural states tremendously. Those points I would hope would be recognized. And when we talk about increased productivity, we've also got to, again, balance that against the unemployment. So those, and particularly that's certain. If we can get away with it, Mr. President, it's great. But if they should retaliate or imply that they will retaliate, it's going to have a disastrous impact on a state like mine.
Governor, let me cover that, because all of you, to a certain extent, represent agricultural states. We don't take Illinois. It's considered to be a great, as it is, it's a great industrial state with a huge city. But there are 2,500,000 people who depend on agriculture in the state of Illinois, correct?
Right. Yeah. We get the biggest agriculture for it.
About California. But there it is.
I think this is a very important point that you carry back to your farmers. And frankly, 30% of the people, while they're very few farmers, they're 30% of the people who either directly or indirectly are affected on the farm. Missouri is another thing we see. Look at these little, you go fly over, you go to the country, you see the little lights down there, you know, farm to farm, and you see a little cluster of a town.
Well, the town wouldn't be there if it weren't for the farms,
etc. Now, the agricultural exports are frankly the only bright thing in the American export-import picture. The reason is that American agriculture is the most productive phase of our whole economy. Much of it, while American industry is, in some parts of it, has dragged its feet and become uncompetitive, American agriculture is ahead of the world. We can beat anybody in the world in agriculture. Anybody in the world. To the great credit of the American farmers, to the great credit of the equipment manufacturers and all the rest, the researchers, the Department of Agriculture, the State Department. Now, the purpose of the temporary surcharge, which we have, and also the purpose of our action on the monetary market, letting the dollar float, it is not to build a wall around the United States and stop trading, but the purpose is to get a fair deal on trade, to open up markets that previously have been closed to us. And once we get a fair deal, when other countries revalue their money so that we are not at a disadvantage, once we get a fair deal in terms of trade barriers, some of them have trade barriers that very cleverly get around the gap, all that sort of thing, called non-tariff barriers, you know. Once we get a fair deal, then we'll be prepared to negotiate on a surcharge of 10%. We'll be prepared to negotiate with regard to international monetary. Now, how does that look to agriculture down the road? Temporarily, you will hear, as you well pointed out, correctly, temporarily you will hear that as a result of the search
countries are going to retaliate against the United States, and naturally, they will pick the retaliation American agricultural products, because we export so much. We have a $2 billion surplus where agricultural products are concerned. On the other hand, long-term, and by long-term, that doesn't mean 10 years from now, but within a reasonable time, as we negotiate with regard to our exchange rates, we negotiate with regard to the surcharge, we negotiate with regard to non-tariff barriers, and with regard to burden sharing around the world, where the United States of America pays two-thirds of the cost of free world events. As we negotiate all those things, it is our purpose that the United States live in a world that is competitive, that we will compete in, and we will trade. Now, long term, who's going to be the major beneficiary of that? American agriculture. Because you can only sell abroad those things that are competitive. And one thing that we are competitive is in agriculture. We can sell a lot more soybeans, everything else that you can imagine abroad. If they open up some market, take the Europeans. There's some really good things that we could break through there. So what we have got here, Governor, what we have developed is something we haven't preached. I know that, and this is true of every candidate for president talking in the Farm Bill, Humphrey and I both said this in 1968. Jack Kennedy and I said it in 1960. We said, what we've got to do as we go into the Farm Bill is to have more markets abroad for America's great surpluses. Of course we're going to have more markets abroad. But the difficulty is, we have not had a negotiating tool. Now we have changed the name. We've got a stronger negotiating tool. And I can assure you that as we do negotiate with these countries abroad, and it will be difficult over a period of time, that we will have very much in mind the fact that one of the major areas where we can increase our sales abroad, where we are totally competitive, is in agriculture. So that's the answer that we have there.
Mr. President, may I address myself?
Sure.
While I have supported you completely on your wage price freeze, I have not supported your policy on agriculture, as I think probably you know. And one of the problems I think we have is communication with the Department of Agriculture. I'm going over there tomorrow to talk about it rather than burden you with it today. We've talked here today about corporate profits, about more higher salaries for teachers and others. A segment of our economy that's in much worse shape today than the teaching profession is agriculture. Now, we can talk about, I really think that the farmers of America today are the ones who are paying for what you have just outlined. I think we have not done a good job. I think probably, generally, you will concur with my position on that. Not only do we have to look to the long-range needs of agriculture, and certainly world trade is an important part of that. In addition to that, we need to look to the short-range needs. I won't go into a long dissertation on agriculture here now, because my fellow governors hear me talk about it all the time. But I have suggested to the Secretary of Agriculture the very least he could do was to extend for 90 days the October 1st call-up of 67 and 68 corn and sorghum. And I can't get an answer from him. I'm going over personally tomorrow to try and get that. And if he can't do it, all I want him to do is say no, and he can't. But time's a-wasting. We've only got about 10 or 12 more days. I think that we have got to do more for our agricultural economy, and you might have one way of doing it, and I might have another, but I hope that we can work towards that end.
I know that the President has another obligation, and I know he's very interested.
So is I, but he's trying to get energy.
My party here. I'll leave it as the President's discretion when he cuts it off. Just want to call attention to the
might I have 30 seconds on the matter of profits again?
You got 30 seconds.
Mr. President, it seems to me that since you have made a very convincing case to me as to why we are using price control and not profit control, would it be possible for you to get off both the economic and the political hook by saying that if increasing productivity or other factors make the profits get too high, you will simply lower the price on that commodity? And use the price control indirectly to control the profits in selected cases. seems to me that would encourage moderation.
There's our experts. We'll put that in and let it just stay.
We're listening.
President, we appreciate the fact that that is up to the company. I understood you say that you're interested in our views and some avenues and that you don't want statements of your time and that we'd like to be able to submit them. I wonder what the city best mechanics think.
Well, the best mechanics, Governor, he would like to have you submit the views to the vice president because he says that he would have everybody a very strong advocate. He's got it already in the views that you have. And you can be sure that your views will be heard and that they hear. We've also set up this new device to buy for the station transport council. Regard to this matter, you're about it, but he will know which offices to go to. And his office is set up for him, too.
I say just one thing. I'd like to reinforce what Governor West commented on earlier, Mr. President, in regard to Phase 2 and its impact on the governors as they prepare their budgets. Like it will be state now, the Blue Ribbon Committee, I think, is important. And I think perhaps you'll have some observations to make there that will be meaningful to the governors and to the people who have prepared the budgets. I just wanted to reinforce this statement.
Mr. President, I just want to like to say that as far as the reduction of federal employees is concerned, through attrition, it is working in Connecticut very well. We're doing it for a different reason. We're broke. The only way that I can find to increase productivity is the entire system, civil service, and so on. The only way we're able to be able to give state employees any more money is to reduce the number of them, and the state is working. I would hope that the Phase 2 have a provision which would guard against retroactivity, which would be a tremendous whiplash, I think, if it were to happen at the end of the 90 days. And I'd like to, while we're leaving for the state of Washington, which is in serious trouble, remember that Connecticut is number 2 in unemployment, and I would hope that Phase 2 would have enough flexibility and it would keep in mind the fact that we, being so heavily tied to the defense industry,
yeah,
are in a very, very bad situation as far as jobs are concerned.
We got the state of Washington, which is Southern California, Orange, Connecticut. You're all in the area, and parts of New Jersey. Well, gentlemen, we appreciate your time. And, I know that all of you who sat around this table at board, you know, I try to give you something to say, home as a remembrance. You had everything I've got. On the other hand, we got a couple of new small items. First, I know that most of the time your wife is talking about where you can. The White House, come off of that. But anyway, here's a small item that Mrs. Nixon and I have made up for a while. It has a presidential seal on it. It doesn't have my name, so it's bipartisan. And if your wife likes a little compact, there's one for your wife. Or your secretary, if you have your secretary. Anyway, we'll give those out to you. Now, for the, we don't want you to go away empty-handed, so we have made up a few little things for today. It's called, this is a presidential seal on a paperweight. And you will note it is very small, and that allows me to give you some very good advice. We all collect paper as we sit here, you know, in our homes. Come in. Whenever the paper gets so that little old weight won't hold it, throw away the paper. Thank you very much.
Well, if you'll remain for just a few minutes after the president was one of our
Thanks, Tom. We'll remember you.
Thank you.
Bye. Good to see you.
Thanks, Mr. President. I want to tell you how much I appreciate your being here, some of you on quite short notice, and how beneficial I think it's been to us in the administration to have these viewpoints, and particularly some of the ones that surprised me. I thought I was really versatile and knowledgeable about
state and local government, but I must confess that points were raised here that hadn't occurred to me, so I'm sure that applies to some of our other people who will be working in these programs. In conclusion, I want to call on the man who provides the target of opportunity for President Running Press, the White House masochist, Ron Ziegler.
Boss, thank you, Mr. President. You know, there is a good deal of precedence in talking to the staff. I think it would be appropriate for Governor Moore to be briefing with the press if I'd give a brief rundown on me. Because there are the press from many of your local states, your states here, we have set up an arrangement outside of the West entrance where there's a microphone where Governor can give a report together with whoever would like to join you. And then those who would like to talk to your local press, your state press, they will be out to call.